Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, the show started with an AP article that was a couple weeks ago that that looked at Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner and how she came to be reelected at the end of October in Argentina with perhaps the widest victory margin in Argentine history and 54% of the vote. How did she do this in a world where leading economies are slowing, smaller countries are swallowing unpopular austerity measures in exchange for financial lifelines? The article says since she and her late husband and predecessor, Néstor Kirchner, moved into the presidential palace in 2003, they presided over one of the longest periods of economic growth in the country's history, growing twice as fast in real terms as the economic powerhouse of Brazil and faster than any other nation in the world, save China and India. They also cut the wealth gap, the difference in income between the 95th and 5th percentile, nearly in half, by nearly tripling social spending in real terms. They rebuilt industrial capacity in the country after the 2001 economic collapse, created jobs, lowered poverty, and put disposable income into many pockets, so people are going out and buying cars and televisions, etc. Can this last? Is there a risk of very, very high inflation? We're going to be looking at what's going on in Argentina this hour of the program, and I think it ought to be a fascinating hour. Our guest is Professor Maria Victoria Murillo, professor of political science and in the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University. She has a joint appointment with political science and the School of International and Public Affairs. Her research on distributive policies in Latin America has covered labor politics and labor regulations, public utility reform, education reform, and economic policy. She received her BA from the Universidad de Buenos Aires and her MA and PhD from Harvard University. She's also taught at Yale. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. And Professor Murillo, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks to you for the invitation. It's
yeah,
a pleasure.
Great to have you here. So tell me, why does Argentina have the fourth strongest economy in the whole wide world?
Well, I mean, you have to understand a little bit of what happened over time. I mean, so Argentina didn't have such a great economic performance before. I mean, the 2001, 2002, I mean, from 1998 to 2003, it faced a recession that became a dramatic one in the year 2002. The GDP dropped like 20%, between 20 and 25%. So when the Kirchners were inaugurated, Néstor Kirchner, who was the first of the two to be president in 2003, it was a very peculiar situation. The country was starting to grow after this dismal trajectory. He was elected with only 23% of the vote in a very divided, you know, there were many candidates. No, the candidate with the most votes had only 25% was former President Menem, who had, you know, taken the country into market reforms during the 90s. And there was a second round because no candidate had achieved the necessary, you know, proportion of votes, which is under the current constitution, over 45%, with a 10-point difference with the runner-up. So before the second round, President Menem figured out very fast that everybody was converging towards the runner-up, who was Néstor Kirchner, so he dropped out. So Néstor Kirchner arrived to power in 2003 with very weak legitimacy. So that's an important thing to take into consideration. The country had suffered a huge economic crisis and a huge political crisis in the year 2001, which was the prior, you know, election. You know, about a quarter of the voters had decided to null their vote, to vote blank. So there was a lot of discontent with politicians. The country had gone a process where people, you know, went into the streets claiming for all the politicians to leave. the famous phrase in Spanish was que se vayan todos, so, you know, throw them all out. So it was a moment of, you know, if you would think, you know, a huge Occupy Wall Street, but in a much larger dimension.
Mm-hmm.
So the country is coming from this very big political and economic crisis, and this guy gets to office with the following two conditions. The country had defaulted on the external debt, so this is very similar, you know, after having lived a very similar situation to the Greek current situation,
mm-hmm.
And therefore, by defaulting on the debt, it has stopped paying it, which was a huge source, a huge drain on the treasury. So the government couldn't pay salaries in 2001. It had to cut public salaries by a third just to be able to pay, you know, the service of the debt. By defaulting on the debt, currently this money becomes available to the government.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing that happens, again, similar to the current Greek situation, is that Argentina had a fixed exchange rate with a convertibility to the dollar until January of 2002. So it basically had no monetary policy. And in January of 2002, they decided to abandon this and to devalue. And basically the dollar moved from $1 to a peso to 4 pesos to a dollar. So it's a huge devaluation. So with these two things into consideration, at the time where the prices of commodities start to rise, you know, this is the booming of China and India, and Argentina is a huge producer of commodities. Suddenly, with the devaluation, the commodities become very competitive, and, you know, the prices of Argentine products start growing up. Argentina starts producing exports, and this export economy starts driving economic growth very, very dramatically from the first years, you know, thanks to the devaluation. And, you know, and then to the increasing price of the Argentine products. The Argentina produces mostly agricultural products and then industries in terms of exports, industries that are associated with agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of it, what Kirchner did in his first administration was basically to help this process. So he benefited from the increases in commodity prices. He keep, you know, the exchange rate competitive. And also, when he had to negotiate the external debt because he had to go out of the default, he basically sit down with the creditors and said, you know, we want the economy to grow, therefore we really cannot pay what you want. If you want to, you know, get your money back, you need to accept a haircut. And the haircut was the largest in history. So again, look at Greece, because this was, you know, the creditors had to accept a cut, a very sizable cut. But remember that at some point the Argentine bonds, in nominal values, in 2002, I think they were valued between 10 and 12 cents for each dollar. So they had, you know, in nominal value, they had lost a lot. And then Argentina defaulted. And so he said, you know, if you accept this haircut, you know, we'll pay.
Uh-huh.
So the majority of the creditors did accept. And so he solved a lot of these, you know, external debt problems with this process of renegotiation.
Who held the
debt? So that was a very bold move and one that was very important in, you know, putting Argentina back in its feet.
Who held the debt?
Banks. I mean, it was privately held for the most part. The government never renegotiated the debt with the IMF and the World Bank. That debt the government paid eventually with services, and then when Cristina Kirchner was inaugurated, they paid with reserves of the central bank, because by then Argentina had money, and so it repaid to the international institutions. So this is privately held debt,
and
banks, investors, and so on.
And once they had money, they did an agenda that is so incredible that so many young people who would have been out on the streets were back in school. The poverty rate, the disparity between those who have and those who have not was cut in half. Tell us more about the social agenda that ensued.
Okay, so when they get to power again, I think it's important to bear in mind that there was not a lot of electoral legitimacy, and it's a very strong contrast between the election of Néstor Kirchner and the re-election of Cristina Fernández de Kirchner.
Mm.
And in fact, a lot of the policies have to show this difference. So, for instance, when Kirchner was elected, he didn't have a lot of electoral support, so he starts moving with a lot of, you know, made a lot of bold moves so as to garner such electoral support. So he attracted the middle classes with a very strong policy on human rights, on you know, prosecuting prior human rights abuses during the military dictatorship that had, you know, there had been judges to the military juntas that had governed the country. But then under turmoil, the President Menem had pardoned the people who were in prison. So he went back and, you know, pushed for the cancellation of these pardons and prosecute them. Then there is, like, reform of the military, reform of the police. And they start to, you also follow on the pre-existing policies, social policies. There's a cash transfer program called Plan Jefes y Jefas that, you know, was at some point in 2002 covered like, a 22% of the families in the country because of the crisis. So they continue with this plan. But the most important thing is that because of the real salaries had declined so much, they push for real gains in salaries. So they increase the minimum wage, a very strong increase in the minimum wage. The labor ministry, Argentina has a very interventionist labor law, and the labor ministry sides in a kind of obvious way with the labor unions. The labor unions had always been powerful, had always been allied to the Peronist Party, and the increase in real wages in the formal sector of the economy, which is the sector that labor unions represent, is pretty, pretty dramatic.
Mm.
There is a huge decline in unemployment. Unemployment moved from like 20-something to now it must be 7-8%, which is relatively low given the numbers that Argentina had before. And there are also policies that benefit the large informal sector. So informality declined a bit thanks to the booming economy, but there's also an extension of the social security, the pensions, to people who are not in the formal economy. So that benefits the formal economy, and subsequently the introduction of one of these cash transfer programs that the World Bank has, you know, touted all around Latin America, which is called Asignación Universal por Hijo, which means that if you are a kind of a poor person and you have a child, you get money if you send your child to school, and you send, you get him or her vaccinated and so on and so forth.
It sounds almost unreal, doesn't it, when you look at what everybody else in the world is dealing with right now?
Well, if you look at the region in general, most countries in the region have grown in the last decade.
Mm.
Argentina is not unique by any standard. Its growth has been a little bit more rapid than the rest of the region. But all countries with left-wing and right-wing governments have grown pretty dramatically, have seen declines in inequality as a result of economic growth. And all of them have this kind of conditional cash transfer programs to include people in the informal sector, because during the 90s, you know, there has been a trend in increasing informality, but during the 90s, this increase has been very, very dramatic. So this is a policy that's, you know, even the right-wing government in Mexico or Colombia had these policies, and the left-wing government in Bolivia and Ecuador has the same kind of cash, conditional cash transfer program.
Oh, that's fascinating.
So it's a pretty widespread policy.
Yeah.
I don't think it's an invention of Argentina in that regard. And it's also true that the whole region has benefited from the increasing commodity prices and has tried to take advantage of that.
Right.
Now, the risks of these policies, and I think that is interesting to see in the last election, she got 54% of the vote, is that Argentina, along with Venezuela, are the two countries that are facing the highest problems in terms of inflation.
Uh-huh.
So starting in 2006, the government starts facing inflationary problems. And they remember that in the late 80s and early 90s, Argentina lived through hyperinflation, so people is pretty afraid of that.
Mm-hmm.
So in 2006, when the inflation starts to pick up, I think that's the first year that it reaches 10%, the government starts putting limits to exports, in particular to exports of food, so that's to reduce the domestic price. So, for instance, Argentina exports meat, and so there's controls on the export of meat, so as to reduce domestic price of meat. And there is also price controls. And the most dramatic thing that the government does is in 2007, it takes over what's the equivalent of the Census Bureau in the U.S. and kicks out basically the technicians in charge and changes the method for measuring inflation. And so the current method for measuring inflation is basically not trusted by anyone, to the point that the labor leaders say, we don't use this number for, collective bargaining. Right. The people say, we go to the supermarket and we don't trust this number. And so there's people use for all, purpose of commercial interactions, alternative measures of inflation by private consultants or by the provincial kind of equivalent. This is a federal country, of the Census Bureau. But the government has been, because the government is paying their creditors on, bonds that are indexing by the official index of inflation, the government is cracking down on anybody who's trying to measure inflation alternatively.
So interesting.
A very contentious issue. There's people who have been fined, threats to send them to prison if they publicize inflation indexes that are alternative to the government. So that issue, the issue of how to measure inflation has become a very politicized one.
Mm-hmm. And tell me more about President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. Is she a strong political leader? Does she know what she's doing? Is she well-loved?
Well, she is very strong now in the sense that she got a lot of electoral support. She's taking some measures, starting this week. The government has had subsidized prices. For instance, they froze prices on electricity, gas, all of the public services in 2002, and they have not been able to, modify them. And with inflation that's in the level of 20%, that means that these companies are suffering, and therefore the government is paying subsidies to remunerate the companies. These subsidies have a very high cost on the fiscal deficit. In the last 2 days, the government has announced that it will start to cut subsidies and has, started the process cutting the subsidies to the most, to the biggest companies. So, if you had a casino, now you don't get electricity subsidized by taxes anymore. Mm-hmm. If you have a big company of mobile telephone, you don't get your electricity and your gas subsidized anymore. Mm-hmm. That was announced yesterday.
Mm.
So the government is facing some of these fiscal pressures, and because she has this very strong electoral support, she's able to do it. When her husband came, because he didn't have such a big electoral support, he couldn't take on these measures that would be clearly unpopular.
Yeah. We're going to welcome phone calls for you. Our guest this hour is Professor Maria Victoria Murillo, Professor of Political Science in the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University. And we're talking about what is going on in Argentina, coming to our attention because of the re-election just a couple of weeks ago of the president, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner of Argentina. She has been riding a wave of prosperity that's been going on for some years now. We're talking about why there's been such prosperity, if they run a risk of it all collapsing due to inflation. It was interesting what Professor Murillo said, wasn't it, that it's happening no matter what the political persuasion of the government, be it a right-wing government or a left-wing government, that so many of the countries are experiencing the same kind of boom, economic prosperity. So obviously the question we ask is, can we learn from them? We're going in a different direction. Is there something that is helpful for us to know about those countries? We'd love to hear from you, and I'm sure there are some experts in this part of the world who are listening right now. Here is the number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Lines are open for you right now. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about Argentina, why the economy is doing so incredibly well right now, the re-election of the female president in Argentina, and the bigger question we haven't gotten to yet is that, are there things that other countries in the world that are experiencing economic hardship can learn from Argentina, or is this economic boom relatively short-lived and it runs a risk of completely collapsing? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And we have our first call in. It's Jim from Waupun. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I just wanted to say that what she described in the last few moments about Argentina's economy was, to me, a classic summary of what happens in boom and bust capitalism. The high rollers had to take a haircut, as she said, and the high rollers in our country don't want to take that haircut. They've gotten out of it before by getting us into war, like World War II and so on. But I think the basic important fact, I think, for us to remember in terms of the Occupy Wall Street movement is that for every, in the next year or so, for every emperor Republican politician that stands there with no clothes on a year from now, there's also going to be an emperor Democrat politician standing there with only his underwear on because they were complicit in bringing us to where we are right now. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Jim, for the call. Professor Maria.
Yes. I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, I've been in Sukhoti Park recently looking at the Occupy Wall Street, and I've been through the protest in Argentina. I mean, the level of violence was much more dramatic in Argentina because the middle class, I mean, basically the government took over the savings. You couldn't take your money out of the bank. So the middle classes went on the street and basically attacked banks, attacked politicians. And the discomfort with all political parties was enormous at the time. But what is interesting is that the Peronists, the party of the current administration, was able to reinvent themselves. And now being so popular, it's the same party that in the 1990s had, you know, moved the country towards trade liberalization, deregulation, and the most kind of neoliberal or Republican-oriented, if you would want to think it here, supply-side politics. And then it became protectionist again in the 2000s. And that was I agree with the call that this is part of the boom and boost policy. So it's easy to do it when you have a commodity boom and you have money. But what's also interesting is that the electorate, because the economy is doing well and they have, you know, a value money in their pockets, they're also willing to hear the same party changing the policies.
Mm-hmm. Are people in Argentina kind of sitting on the edge of their seats saying, "Ooh, I hope this lasts, but I don't know if it's going to or not. I'm worried."
The Argentinians have believed, the Argentine economy has always been a boom and boom and boost economy. It has faced, you know, this has been the longest spurt since the early 20th century of growth, but it has faced many times periods of boom and boost. So the Argentinians are kind of trying to take advantage of this, but they are expecting the crisis. They are expecting the next crisis. To give you a funny anecdote, I was driving a taxi cab in Buenos Aires, and so, you know, I asked the taxi driver, you know, we start talking about the crisis, and the guy said to me, "Well, don't tell me there's going to be another crisis. We all know that. Just tell me when it's going to be." So this is kind of the attitudes of Argentinians.
Huh. So what did you say? Do you know what it's going to be?
I mean, it really now depends a lot on conditions that are external to the country. So what's going on with China and India and the commodity boom? Because the main source of taxes in the country is export taxes, and the exports, you know, so agricultural products are basically sustaining all of the expenditures of the government. So to the extent that agricultural products have prices that go up and the volume of exports has increased dramatically because of higher prices, the country could sustain, but obviously there are limits because the government is facing the cost of subsidies and is starting to take some measures to reduce the fiscal pressure.
Let's go to Habu from Madison. Hi, Habu.
Yes, good morning. It's good to have this topic and your guest on. I would like to start by saying I don't think people in this who are in your audience remember an expression, as rich as an Argentine. There was a time when Argentina was as richer than Canada, and also that coincidentally went with that great economist that Argentina had, Raul Prebisch, who was more about building up the state infrastructure and limiting the imports, and that's what built up Argentina, among other things. But anyway, some of the things that have happened, and I just read a very telling article about comparing the Argentine president and President Obama, and it really shows how ideologically different the two are. The Argentine president cut back the military expenditures, whereas President Obama increased them. The divide in inequalities in the United States has increased, whereas in Argentina they've decreased, and many other things, including the big bond haircut that Argentina imposed on its bondholders. So it's nice to see some people in other parts of the world more enlightened than people who just are so greedy for capital. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the call. Professor?
Yes, I mean, you need to understand that there are different circumstances and different size of the countries. And again, on both the military expenditures and the haircut on the debt. So on military expenditures, the U.S. has a role of, you know, of being an imperial power. Argentina has none. So the only thing that people know the military had served for is to kill its own citizens. We lived through many military dictatorships. The last one, the most brutal of all, that, you know, thousands of people were missing, were tortured, were disappeared, were killed. And so it's a very different attitude towards the armed forces. So the patriotism that, you know, rally around the flag of the United States is less of an issue in Argentina. So the popularity of taking on the military, which has very low levels of support, it's very different there than here. You know, you have a military that had fought wars, that had won wars, that had defended the country. I think it's much easier to take on the military in Argentina than to take on the military expenditures in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So regardless of whatever are the President Obama's preferences, even if he had the same preferences as President Kirchner, which I doubt, I don't think he would be able to do it. And second, on the haircut, the haircut was huge, but the Argentine debt, even though it was big for Argentina, very big and very big for Latin American standards, was five times smaller than the current Greek debt. So a small country, so the cost for the world economy, Argentina defaulted on the debt. There was no way, nobody else defaulted in Latin America after Argentina, you know, forced the creditors to take the haircut. The creditors accepted it, but there was no wave, no contagion in the region. Now we're talking about Greece, which is not such a big country anyway. It has five times the size of the Argentine debt, and the fear that people have is the contagion, the effect on the euro, the effect on the rest of Europe, the effect of in the rest of the world. So I think, again, you know, in the U.S. would never be able to default on the debt because it would produce a collapse of the world economy, whereas Argentina defaulted on the debt and produced a domestic collapse. Mm. A lot of people suffer, poverty increased dramatically, unemployment increased dramatically, but it was suffered mostly by Argentinians, not by anybody else.
Mm. Could you say, or is this way off base, that none of the prosperity could have happened in Argentina if the country had not defaulted on its debt?
I think no doubt that the default on the debt was good for Argentina. It was very costly short term. I mean, this is something that I think every day when I see the Greek situation.
Uh-huh.
Very costly. That year, 2002, was a dramatic year. People took, you know, if they were lucky enough to have a job, the real value of their wage declined, you know, from 100 to 25%. So they took three quarters of it because of the devaluation. And, you know, unemployment increased to 25%. Poverty increased to between poverty and indigency to like half of the population. People were, you know, using barter because, you know, there was no money, no trusting the money, no banks, no economic activity. very, very dramatic year. The cause was dramatic for the people of Argentina. And people, that's why they're so thankful that now the economy is doing well. So don't think that there's no cause. Now, after that happened, the state that was completely constrained in 2001, they couldn't even pay salaries, was, you know, liberated to use money for other means. So they could use it for social policy, which starts dramatically under Kirchner's predecessor, Eduardo Duhalde, and they use it for paying salaries, for getting things going on. So I think it helped on Argentina recovery, no doubt, but it would have also not been the same had not, you know, the devaluation happened and Argentinians' exports really bring the economy to where it is. And Argentina was the seventh economy of the world at the beginning of the 20th century, at the time when it was a very open country, when commodity prices were very high, and it was based on exactly the same type of products that the current growth is based on, agricultural production. So that's, you know, the Argentina's pampas is the natural resources, and that's what, you know, produced a lot of growth and, you know, a lot of wealth at the turn of the 20th century, and it's the same thing that is producing the growth now.
Mm-hmm. Joshua in Richland Center. Hi, Joshua.
Hello. I'm happy to hear that the Argentina people responded to collapse with a barter system. That intrigues me because it shows the Argentinas to be able to possess true skills that they could trade or perhaps trade things in which they can grow. And, you know, the impact on the Argentinas, as I've read, is when that happened, people thought about basic human needs and went back to more of a traditional culture. My question is what can we learn as a culture here in America? A lot of the boom and bust that we'll see is a shortage of natural resources, and we're stripping our fields away in southwest Wisconsin for corn and beans. And I'm just wondering, what is happening to the ecological matters when it comes to Argentina's boom economy that is showing economic growth? And with economic growth, are people being fed and housed?
Well, there's two different issues here. There is the issue of sustainability, and I think the policies, there's a huge discussion to what extent Argentinians are, you know, overusing their land to take advantage of the commodity boom. And soy, in particular, is taking over most of the area of cultivation because of soy prices. So there's a huge discussion of what would be the longer-term consequences of this commodity boom. The cattle production has been completely moved up north to much less, you know, to lands that are not good for agriculture, and so it has suffered a lot. And so it's not clear to me in the short term that this will not have negative environmental effects. On the other boom of Argentina is the mining boom. The government has veto all, the government of Cristina Kirchner has veto all the laws that, you know, respect environment. There is like open air mining. There's a lot of social protest against that in the affected communities. The government has allowed mining even in the icebergs, you know, in the mountains, in the glaciers. And so, again, it doesn't seem to me that the long-term environmental effects are being paid attention to. This is like a pending assignment of the current government, no doubt. I think all of the people in the environmental movement are particularly unhappy about these policies. Also, there's been, you know, a legal order to clean the huge river that goes through the city of Buenos Aires with a lot of industries are installed, and that has not been made despite many fights and many years and a Supreme Court ruling. So, again, that's actually a pending assignment, the environment, I would say. And so that is something that I would not classify certainly as positive of the current development of Argentina, and we probably won't really pay attention to the consequences while we are in the boom. In the United States, though, the agricultural producers are also doing well. I mean, it's interesting that, you know, it's so hard to get them to take the subsidies from this sector, which is booming, not just in Argentina, but all over the world.
Thanks, Joshua, very much for the call. We welcome more phone calls. We're looking at what's going on in Argentina, which is experiencing a significant boom right now. And their president, her story is interesting as well, won re-election last month by what has been described as a landslide. Her name is President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. Her husband had been president. And why is it that this country is doing so well? We're looking at the history of it and if there is anything that the world economy can learn from Argentina, which typically goes through boom and bust, according to our guest, who is Professor Maria Victoria Murillo, Professor of Political Science and International and Public Affairs at Columbia University, author of Political Competition, Partisanship, and Policymaking in the Reform of Latin American Public Utilities, co-editor of Argentine Democracy, The Politics of Institutional Weakness, and she has written extensively on a number of other issues. Her research on distributive policies in Latin America has covered labor politics, labor regulations, public utility reform, education reform, and economic policy more generally. So call us if you'd like. She's filled with information, 800-486-8655. We have some emails coming in as well, which we will go to momentarily, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to an email from Ariadna. There are indicators about strength of democracy. Some are health and education. Argentina is not as good as your guest has mentioned. People are dying of starvation every day. Malnutrition is rampant. There are many children and people asking for money or food on the streets. Education used to be internationally recognized. It is not now. It is going down in an alarming way. Do you want to respond to that, Professor Maria?
Yes. Yes. Okay. It's true that Argentina has declined educational performance. There's no doubt about that. Using the PISAC funds, Argentina has declined in its performance for the quality of education. And that's particularly problematic given that the government has increased dramatically expenditures on education. It's really like more than 5% of GDP of 5% of GDP, and this is huge expenditures, but the consequences of it are not what one would expect. A lot of the expenditures go to salaries, so the real salaries of teachers have increased very, very substantially during these administrations, and the debate that people have is why that the quality of the outcomes is not as good. Some people qualify and argue that this is because the same discussion as here, to what extent teachers should given like across the board wage increases or, you know, merit performance based increases. The increases have happened and the outcomes have not show improvement. A lot of the expenditures also go to the university system. The universities are free and open, the public universities, to everyone who wants to enter. But of course, the poor very rarely made it to the university because they, you know, basically drop out at the high school level, most mm-hmm. likely, to start working. So that's a huge subsidy for the middle class that makes it to the university and pays nothing. Another debate that's been lingering for many years, but it's very unpopular. Nobody wants to take in the university, given that university students are very easy to mobilize. The last time someone did this was a prime minister that lasted for like a week. So huge expenditures on education, the outcome of those expenditures in terms of performance, especially at lower levels, is not good. Even at the level of universities, the public universities that have declined in the ranking in the world, and this is certainly something that happened. They have been massified. Many more people get degrees. They don't pay for it. It probably reaches people who would not be able to pay for it at the cost of quality. Mm-hmm. Now, poverty and infant mortality. Infant mortality has declined since the crisis. There's still people who live off malnutrition, who die of malnutrition, especially in the north of the country, which is the most poor regions. In those poor regions, one thing that does happen with the social policies under the Kirchner, and actually not just under the Kirchner, but under any Peronist administration, is the politicization of the delivery of social policies. So at the local level, so the social policies like health are decentralized. This is a federal country, to the provinces, and the provinces decentralized to the municipalities. And there's huge variation in how the municipalities deliver these social benefits. So some people had studied, for instance, like a food delivery program, and how in some administration it was like basically given to anybody who needed it, and in other municipalities it was given to the people that the mayor decided, you know, they're all poor, but like the poor who would vote for him. So clientelism is still rampant in the delivery of social policies, in particular in the most poor areas of the country, and that affects, of course, you know, all of the money you spend, if it's not well spent, still doesn't produce great outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
There was another question, but I think it was mainly this. There's still poverty. There's always been poverty. I am Argentina. I grew up there. And this is something that's sad, that under these circumstances has not declined. There's people asking for money, kids asking for money in the streets, people stealing the garbage. That was very dramatic increase during 2002, but has not disappeared. In fact, the sector that benefited the most by the growth is the formal sector of the economy, the people who are represented by labor unions. There's a huge, probably real-term increase of 30%, even taking into consideration the return to the, not the devaluation. But in the informal sectors, in particular with the high levels of inflation that we are experiencing there, it's not so good.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so good. And the informal sector has declined, but still more than a third of the economy.
The other country that we hear about frequently is Brazil, and Brazil, India, and China are always mentioned together as the countries that are really holding up the economy of the rest of the world. And now we're hearing about Argentina as well. Are there similar things going on in those two countries?
Brazil and Argentina, it's interesting. Argentina, somebody mentioned before, it was like the richest, you know, it was like the seventh richest country of the world in 1905. Brazil is now the seventh economy of the world, I believe. So one has taken the place of the other. But Brazil has also benefited by the commodity boom pretty dramatically. There's also a huge program, social policy increase called the Bolsa Familia, which is, as I mentioned before, a cash transfer program to the poor so that they send their kids to school and to health controls. This is the largest in the region. I think it covers like 18 million people. Has also resulted in a decline in inequality and poverty. Now, Brazil starts from a much worse point of view in terms of human development. Poverty had traditionally been much more rampant and dramatic in Brazil. The levels of inequality, Brazil used to be called Belindia, you know, Belgium and India together. The levels of inequality had always been more dramatic than Argentina. So in terms of improvement, I think Argentina has not done as good as Brazil, given the economic growth. Brazil has done better, but probably, you know, if you are going to be born under, you know, and you don't know which is your social class, you probably, you know, under the veil of ignorance, would choose Argentina over Brazil. But the trajectory is much more dramatically positive in Brazil than it is in Argentina.
And what about getting back to something you said earlier, that there are right-wing governments and there are left-wing governments who are experiencing the same kind of boom because of commodities. What about the right-wing governments? Where is all the money going?
Well, as I said, I mean, in fact, the right-wing governments tend to be elected because the countries have, Chile is an exception, but in the case of Mexico, in the case of Colombia, security issues.
Mm.
So both Mexico and Colombia have right-wing administration and huge problems with drugs. So security, you know, and expenditures on the war on drugs are pretty high in these countries, much more than in others. What I said that's particularly strikingly in the similarity is not just that they all benefit from the commodity boom, but that the social policies that were started in the 1990s in Mexico under what was called Progresa, which is this idea of giving a cash transfer to mothers, so that they would send their kids to school and health checks, has really spread across the region regardless of the ideology of the government. So all the countries of the region have it. regardless of the ideology. And that, I think, is a dramatic phenomena, but it's explained by the size of the informal sector. There's a lot of informality in all of these countries, and these are people who are not going to benefit by increases in real wages established either by the government or by labor unions.
Mm-hmm. We have time for a few more phone calls if you'd like to join our conversation. Professor Maria Victoria Murillo is our guest, professor of political science and international and public affairs at Columbia University. We asked her to join us as we were following news of the re-election of the president of Argentina by a landslide. Her story is also interesting. President Cristina Fernandez, her husband had been president. He died, and she has done some remarkable things where economies in the world are really slowing down and smaller countries are putting together austerity measures so that they can get some financial lifelines. In Argentina, although there is a risk of inflation, the money has been pouring in, and we're finding out why that's the case and what the potential concerns are and how they have changed a number of programs. A lot of people have benefited as a result of this boom time. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you would, because you seem to be quite familiar with the situation with Greece as well, is there something that they can learn from Argentina, or that is this a unique situation? And I'm interested in what you think is going to happen with the European Union and whether or not Greece will leave, and how their financial situation might be able to be turned around.
Well, it's interesting because Latin America during the 1990s was in a very similar situation to what, you know, Europe is facing now. They all inherited a debt crisis in the 1980s. And the governments all had to basically adopt austerity measures. They, regardless of they were elected, you know, promising left-wing or right-wing policies, everyone adopted more or less the similar policies that were all policies of adjustment, you know, and shrinking of the state, shrinking of fiscal expenditures. So it wasn't that different from what we're seeing today in Europe. Now, Argentina was the most dramatic case, not only in taking these measures, but also in suffering then from low commodity prices in the 1990s, the devaluation of Brazil, which was its main trading partner at the time. And so it faced, like, from 98 to 2001, a period of no growth, where the economy was at the same time, and this is very similar to Greece, tied to the dollar. So there was no monetary policy. It was less dramatic than in Greece because Argentina had not abandoned its currency. It just had established a convertibility board with the dollar, Greece has abandoned the drachma and moved into the euro. So it's a much more complicated thing to devalue. They really need to abandon the currency they have. And it was very popular. The people loved the convertibility because they distrust the government and they distrust the domestic currency, and they feel that you know, only this convertibility to the dollar would warranty the security, that the credits that they had finally credit emerged, they had adopted them in dollars, and so on and so forth. So it's only under the crisis that they basically, once the government collapsed, remember at the end of 2001, the president abandons, you know, quits under the huge protest. There's like five presidents in a week. Nobody wants to be president. It's a really dramatic situation. And in the middle of this dramatic situation, Congress decides to cancel this law, to basically abolish convertibility and allow for a huge devaluation. So that's something. You know, it's kind of, I was thinking when Papandreou proposed yesterday the plebiscite in Greece, what would Argentinians have done before the collapse in December of 2001? Had they been allowed to vote on convertibility, they probably would have sustained it. Mm. The reason why they, you know, the whole crisis happened is because the government took over the checking and the savings account and stopped. The people could not access their own money, and therefore they couldn't pay, and that also stopped the informal economy. And so it's a huge stop in the very immediate stop in the economy. So are the Greek ready enough to this? I'm not sure. As I said, if it happens, my impression is they would probably need to devalue, and they would probably need a haircut of more than 50%, which is the current cut that they've been offered. And they would suffer a lot, and then they probably their economy would recover on tourism or whatever is that the Greeks, you know, and shipment, which are the two main products of Greece. But it's going to be at a very high cost. And the other difference is that, you know, there is the risk of, you know, Portugal, Ireland, Italy joining the move, the contagion effect, that was not the case when Argentina defaulted. And so if this is a much more general effect, I'm not sure that, you know, Greece could recover like Argentina did, because Argentina recovered by being the only one, while the rest of the economy, and in particular the world economy that consume Argentine products, China and India, were growing. So it was a particularly good timing.
Thank you so much for being with us. You've been an exceptionally interesting guest, I think. Professor Maria Victoria Murillo, our guest, she is at Columbia University and from Argentina originally. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this program and to Chrissy Pease for production on air in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Thank you for listening.